From Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International, it's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming.
My mom told me that if I had an out-of-body experience, that I should be really careful because something else could get into my body and walk around with it, so I should really be careful of that, which terrified me. It terrifies me to this day.
Young adult fantasy author Holly Black, we'll meet her today as we explore the power of magical thinking. Also, the true confessions of a Dungeons & Dragons addict.
You can do anything you can do in real life. You can marry, you can join political parties. In fact, you can do a lot of stuff that you would perhaps have a chance of doing in real life were you not spending all your time playing this game.
And Laura Miller talks about her long, tumultuous relationship with C.S. Lewis's Chronicles of Narnia. But first, the secret.
I don't care if you're an Indian, if you're in Australia, New Zealand, Stockholm or London, or Toronto or Montreal or New York. We're all working with one power. One law. It's attraction. The secret is the law of attraction. Everything that's coming into your life, you are attracting into your life. And it's attracted to you by virtue of the images you're holding in your mind. It's what you're thinking. You see, whatever is going on in your mind, you are attracting to you. Now, wise people have always known that. You can go right back to the ancient Babylonians. They've always known this. It's a small, select group of people. Why do you think that 1% of the population earns around 96% of all the money that's being earned? Do you think that's an accident? It's no accident. It's designed that way. They understand something. They understand the secret. And you are being introduced to the secret.
The simplest way for me to look at the law of attraction is if I think of myself as a magnet, and I know that a magnet will attract to it.
Very basically put, the law of attraction says that like attracts like.
And that principle can be summed up in three simple words. Thoughts become things.
That's a clip from the film version of The Secret. There are also two best-selling books about The Secret by Rhonda Byrne, and The Secret was featured on Oprah Winfrey's TV show. Robert Price writes about the popularity of The Secret in his book Top Secret, The Truth Behind Today's Pop Mysticisms. In his book, Price describes Americans as sheep without a shepherd. He told Anne Strangechamps whether he thinks everyone would be better off if they just stuck to mainstream religions.
Well, that depends on how you define it. The, to me, alarming growth of the influence of Rick Warren shows that people are in the grip of traditional religion, yet its personal savior, fundamentalism, which is not historic Christianity, doesn't really go back before the 18th century, this kind of terminally sticky pietism of me and my imaginary friend Jesus, that seems to provide a great deal of meaning for people. Look at Rick Warren's book sales and so forth.
What it says, the purpose-driven life?
Yes. And there's some thought he may have a magazine now, and he's got various other books and this huge movement. Foreign governments are asking for his help. Fidel Castro requested a signed copy of his book. That I cannot fathom. And it's just from my standpoint, as one who has a doctorate in theology as well as another in Bible, it's just the worst kind of puerile drivel. It's not because he's a conservative Christian that I have a problem, but it's this dumbed down infantilism. Are they seeking help in traditional religion, or is this itself a kind of garish, silly cult? And I think it is the latter, sadly.
Well, tell me something about the whole genre of, I think you've called it pop mysticism. I think of it as kind of supermarket spirituality. There's a lot of books that have been huge bestsellers. The Secret by Rhonda Byrne, for instance, which Oprah did, I think, not one but two programs on. What do you think about books like that?
Well, Rhonda Byrne's book is a classic example of the kind of thing I'm talking about with dumbed down spirituality. Wayne Dyer would be another. What they have at bottom is a sound psychological message that is easy to defend, that we're always sending out subtle signals that we don't realize and that others don't consciously recognize, but we invite positive or negative responses and we get them. We are, to a large degree, creating our own interpersonal social reality. We ward off success because we're afraid of it. That's not spooky. That's not mystical. B.F. Skinner could explain how that works. But then this is something one ought to learn. It's very important. So yes, you can visualize the positive and make that your focus and repeat positive affirmations to yourself because you're simply reprogramming your subconscious. It's just meditation. There's nothing even debatable about that. But then I'm told by Rhonda Byrne and the others that that's not all there is to it. I don't have a right to understand that if I don't also believe in monist metaphysics, that there is something called the Source with a capital S, and that it is full of abundance and whatever I want, it wants. And because the universe is set up with magnetic resonances, if I want, for example, a new job, I need to focus on that, and magnetically the vibes will align. I don't know where you studied physics, Rhonda Byrne, but jobs don't have magnetic resonances. Relationships aren't a matter of vibratory frequencies. This is just sort of pseudoscience. And it's so sad that this repels people that know enough to recognize it as just gibberish, when in fact, at bottom, that requires none of this. They're setting up a false stumbling block. You don't need to get into that crazy stuff to see that the basic idea of it is quite sound and helpful.
Hmm. So describe the secret. What is the secret that Rhonda Byrne claims to have uncovered?
The law of attraction. This was first formulated, I think, in any recognizable way, very much like what people are saying now, back at the turn of the 20th century. Mary Baker Eddy, Phineas Parkhurst, Quimby, and others who began Christian Science movement, the Unity School of Christianity, Science of the Mind, churches, and so on, they put forth this notion that there is a law in the universe and that God is, in a sense, reducible to a matrix of natural laws, unseen but manipulable, and that the essence is that positive attracts positive, like attracts like, negative attracts negative. And if you are preoccupied with the negative, well, you can expect the negative to happen to you. If you insist on being optimistic and aiming for the positive, you're going to bring that about. And it's because the factors of the universe will shift in a kind of physics manner, which is why now they live to bring quantum physics into this, I think completely erroneously.
But so around the turn of the century, when this kind of thinking first arose, you're talking about the school of New Thought or Unity Christianity. It was really a kind of linking of the language of spiritual pursuit and the language of material success.
Yes, it was in some ways. They even at the time said this has ancient roots. We newly recognize it, but it isn't a new gimmick. Christianity does go back to the idea that Jesus Christ is the logos that defines the universe. I mean, that wasn't even heresy, but I think you're right. You've put your finger on a very important point that it becomes a kind of magical manipulation. It's not anti-moral, but it has little to do with it. And this notion of manipulating the universe to succeed and get rich and be prosperous, that's troublesome. And sometimes these people will go farther into the New Age notion and bring in notions of reincarnation and so forth and say, well, if you're not succeeding and if you were born with great handicaps, like the old radio show said, you asked for it. And so I might be even hurting your karma if I tried to help you. Now, that's false religion. That's got to be false. I don't know how to tell a true religion, but that can't be it. That element of make me successful, the Reverend Ike kind of thing, does seem to be uncomfortably dominant in it.
A lot of these, the books, well, The Secret, for instance, Rhonda Byrne's book, they do tend to claim that this kind of thinking goes way, way, way back. I think Rhonda Byrne says that, you know, these are secrets that Plato, Shakespeare, Newton, Lincoln, and Einstein all knew. But is there actually some much older source of some of this thinking?
Well, none of the ancients put it this way. I think what they're recognizing is that the Stoics, for instance, an ancient Greek philosophy, did believe the world was made of God and that it was run by the rational essence of God dispersed through all things. Well, that's an ancient idea. But did the Stoics believe you could get rich and prosperous and successful? No, they rejected things like that. And that's the way it is. Like Einstein, they're trying to piggyback on physics. But certainly this manipulative magic stuff never crossed his mind. And in every case, it's like the Da Vinci Code. They're trying to gain a pedigree by naming big names of the past that never had a thought about this. Or Jesus. Did Jesus teach this? Well, who knows, but you can find one passage where he says, whatever you ask my Father for, ask believing that you've received it and you will. I'll grant that has some, you know, that sounds like what they're talking about, but most of these people, I just don't see where they get it.
Hmm. You can see the appeal of this way of thinking, though. I mean, it's kind of like taking the guesswork out of prayer.
And I think there is a real point to it. I think it's psychologically very sound. But the problem is, and you're quite astute on this too, the problem is the same as with prayer when you start out with a guarantee. People often say, you ask God for it, you claim it in faith, you're going to get it. Well, of course, any adult knows that the pony doesn't wind up under the Christmas tree and the prayer is not answered. And so you say, well, what happened? What's the variable? I guess I didn't have enough faith. I guess God isn't true to his promises. Well, the way you've set this up, it's not viable. And so people will then retreat and say, well, I guess that was pretty silly of me, a mere mortal, thinking I could psych out God and know his will. Oh, all right, that's good and realistic. But the next time they want something, they'll shift back into that I claim it from God mode. And so you hop from one foot to the other as necessary, whether you're talking about prayer or the secret. It's the same thing. It's a kind of a double think mind game, because if you learned your lesson and you said, all right, anything is possible, God is almighty, God could grant me anything, or put it in secular terms, anything could happen, anything's possible, but there's no way for me to know what's going to happen. Gee, that kind of lets the air out of the balloon. Having that kind of confidence is not the kind they think you need. It is going to happen. Might be more realistic to say, could happen, I'm never giving up. But to say, it is going to happen, you're treating God like a genie and you'll definitely, sooner or later, be disappointed. And I'm guessing it's sooner.
Robert Price is the author of Top Secret, The Truth Behind Today's Pop Mysticisms. He's also a professor of scriptural studies at the Johnny Coleman Theological Seminary. Price spoke with Ann Strange Champs. What do you think of this pop mysticism or supermarket spirituality? We'd love to hear from you. You can send us email through our website at ttbook.org. Coming up, The Elfish Gene, Dungeons, Dragons, and Growing Up Strange. And we'll meet fantasy author Holly Black as we continue our Hour on Magical Thinking. I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. Mark Barrowcliffe spent his teen years pretending to be a wizard, a warrior, or an evil priest. He was one of millions of boys who played Dungeons and Dragons during the 1970s and 80s. Barrowcliffe chronicles his obsession with D&D in his memoir, The Elfish Gene, Dungeons, Dragons, and Growing Up Strange. So what is Dungeons and Dragons?
It's a role-playing game. So if you think of the present role-playing games on computers like World of Warcraft and things like that, it's like one of those before they had a computer. So what will happen is there'll be one guy who's the referee who will have either bought or designed this whole kind of world full of monsters and treasure and things like that. And he will have written all this down. And you will have what's called a character, which is a person whose abilities are defined by a set of statistics that you throw dice to see what their strength is, what their intelligence is, things like that. It's more complicated than this. But anyway, you choose to be a wizard, a warrior, maybe a priest, a thief, and you'll have it described to you. So what will happen is the dungeon master will say you're sitting in the Prancing Pony Inn drinking mead when you're approached by a small squat fellow wearing an eye patch. He says, "Psst, you fancy any work? You guys look like adventurers. Are you up for any work? What do you say?" And you might say, "Get lost," or you might say, "Yeah, yeah, what you got?" And from there on, he will say, "Oh, well, you know, blah, blah, we want you to go and rescue this princess that's been captured up at Castle Whatever." Okay, we'll go. And then he'll describe Castle Whatever. And when you come to an encounter, say, with a monster, a guardian of this castle, say, a guard or a troll or something, that troll's abilities are represented by statistics. Yours are represented by statistics. And with reference to a set of tables, you can fight this thing using dice to see who kills who. Yeah. That's it at its most basic level. But it is a role-playing game. So at the more complicated levels, you can do anything you can do in real life. You can marry, you can join political parties. In fact, you can do a lot of stuff that you would perhaps have a chance of doing in real life were you not spending all your time playing this game.
Well, you can see, though, why this is so appealing, can't you, to boys especially who maybe have a little fear of what they might or might not be able to do in real life.
Well, it makes the world very understandable. And as I say, things are reduced to statistics, which is a very comforting thing for men. And I've had things, you know, I've got a website, Elfish Gene website, and I've had guys on there saying, "Yes, I've always thought that RPG is an extremely good reflection of life." And I've replied saying, "Well, I'm not sure they're an exact reflection. You know, you don't approach a girl in the same way as you approach a golden dragon. That's my advice." You know, or if you think, it gives you this idea that certain issues perhaps can be resolved by throwing a dice. You know, you make your saving throw against your wife's anger. Well, in my experience, you have to make quite a few saving throws before that goes away. You know, it's not quite as simple as just, "Is she still angry with me? I shake a 20. "Oh, no, she stopped being angry with me." You know,
don't you wish?
Although, you know, yeah, well, although great steps are taken to try to make these games realistic, particularly in combat systems, and gamers fall into lots of different categories. There are some people who want to know when their character fights a monster exactly where that monster has hit them, virtually what the wound looks like, want to know that when they heal it, they'll be doing it with realistic substances to heal it. And there are other people who just very much more like the shoot 'em up attitude to RPGs online, who just want to go through blasting things, stealing treasure, and don't really want to care about all that kind of thing.
It's kind of like those movies where the bad guy has a revolver that must have 700 bullets in it.
Well, exactly. And there's, you know, what I always say, we were quite into the realism side of it. You know, all I say is, in our world, the Hulk, if he transformed, would have split his shorts. You know, that's we didn't like all that. And people will argue over realism in a game that contains a good amount of vampires, werewolves and dragons. You know, people will say, "That is not realistic, the way your basilisk attacked my giant slug." It wouldn't do it like that.
And they're probably right.
Well, maybe they are. And, you know, we used to kind of spend hours trying to think of what kind of character we'd be in this game. You know, are you going to be a wizard? Are you going to be a monk? What would you be? And people would get really angry about, "You wouldn't ever have the intelligence to be a wizard. You'd have to be a low fighting, the first sort of cannon fodder. That's what you'd be," you know, all this kind of stuff, which was, again, perhaps not good for the self-esteem, but teaches you to stand up for yourself.
Yeah. Hey, do you have a copy of your book with
you? I do.
There's a passage about why D&D is so popular. I wonder if you'd read it for us.
I will. D&D is, I believe, something virtually unique and unprecedented in human history. It's a story that you can listen to at the same time as telling it. You can be surprised by the plot's twists and turns, but you can surprise too. It's more interactive than any other sort of narrative I can think of. If its subject matter were more serious, then it'd probably be considered a new art form. And it's surprising that nothing beyond murder mystery dinners has ever been evolved from it. This is why D&D is so addictive when it's played right. It's like the best story you've ever read, combined with the charge a good storyteller feels as he plays his audience. I think there's a basic human need to listen to stories, but also to tell them. In D&D, you get that tingle you imagine when you think of the ancient storytellers, dusk falling, the campfire burning, and the first line being read. It's not like hearing "In a hole in the ground lived a hobbit." It's like saying it for the first time and to a rapt audience that's dying for your next sentence. I've finished games feeling physically drained and actually wanted to continue to have my characters buy food at a shop or smoke a pipe in a tavern just to calm down before breaking with the game world entirely. And sometimes even that wasn't enough. The crucial difference between conventional forms of storytelling and D&D is that D&D doesn't have to finish, ever. It's an open-ended story, and if you're emotionally engaged with it, the temptation is just to keep going.
Sometimes when you finished a game, did it seem like the real world was black and white?
Very much so. I mean, the real world to me, when I was a teenager, felt like a very unpleasant place, really. I was at an all-boys school where I didn't really feel that I fitted in, a very kind of working-class school where, you know, the emphasis is on being good at sport and being tough and pretending to be, if not actually being, criminal. And, you know, it was a time in England where we didn't realise we were quite poor, but we were actually quite a poor nation. You know, we were still repaying the debt for World War II, for a start. And our economy just really hadn't really got going after World War II. It was racked by strikes. Politics was polarising hugely. It was going either far left or far right at home. And, I mean, it's the same seedbed that gave rise to punk rock in its particular English incarnation, you know, thinking of the Sex Pistols, people like that, which was extremely angry. And we didn't get angry. We just tried to ignore the world, really, and go to a much more colourful place. And as I say in the book, you know, we were more radical than the punks in a way, and we were more radical than the hippies. We didn't need anything to rebel against. We just wanted the real world to go away, which for some of us, it eventually did.
Tell me about the first character you created. He had your name, right? But also...
This wasn't the very first character I created. The very first character I've created was called Rel Ponto the Necromancer, which is a terrible name, but it was in this homemade version of D&D. And he got killed 12 times in the first game. So you let him go
and you created another.
Well, by the dungeon master, who was finding him increasingly irritating. You know, I had hundreds of characters, but yeah, I had one of my characters was called Efilk Worab, which is my name backwards. And he was, I think, I'm trying to remember now, half elf magic user for those who are old enough to remember that. And I personally annoyed the dungeon master so much that he turned my character's head into the head of a mule, which I really liked, but I couldn't actually let on to him that I really liked it, or I knew he'd have turned it back again. So I had this, my character became known as Mule Face, and he was this kind of bottom figure from Midsummer Night's Dream going around.
You talked about some of the games you played. Is there one that stands out? Is the most memorable D&D game you ever played?
There was one time when my friend's mother became convinced that fearful that we'd actually killed someone, because she basically overheard the game, and she came in to offer us a cup of tea, because she didn't really understand what was going on with people shouting, "I hit him, I attack him, I kill him," you know. And she picked up the copy of Empire of the Petal Throne, which had got this huge grinning devil pictured on the front, and was kind of thinking, what is this kind of thing? And all the time she was talking, my character's wife had been killed, and I wanted to resurrect her. And I just had it by the end of it. I just said, "When are you going to stop talking about cakes and tea, woman, and allow us to get on with the game?" And in the end, I just burst out, "Where are we going to store the body?" And she looked at me, and she literally dropped the teapot and just said, "What body?"
Mark Barracliffe is the author of the memoir The Elfish Gene, Dungeons, Dragons, and growing up strange.
I've got Dungeon Master's Guide. I've got 12-sided die.
Holly Black is a fantasy writer. She's best known for writing the Spiderwick Chronicles, a series of children's books which follow the Grace children, who discover a world of fairies. Black's latest book is The Good Neighbors, Book One, Kin. She told Anne Strangechamps what she thinks children get out of reading stories featuring magic or alternative realities.
One of the things that I think that fantasy can do that is the thing that interests me the most about fantasy is that you can look at something that you might look at with realistic fiction and sort of turn it on its side and be able to look at it in a different way. For instance, if you think about anger, we all experience anger. We all experience the kind of anger that maybe makes us afraid we're going to say something or do something that will hurt someone. But if you look at a creature like a werewolf, you know, this is a creature that once a month turns into a monster that hurts the people closest to it. As a metaphor, this literalizes that feeling of anger. This literalizes anger. And it says, okay, we're not going to talk about why you're like that or why we have these feelings or how to stop them, but what happens then? How do you deal with it then if you just say, okay, this is anger and this is me being a werewolf, this is this. You know, we're able to look at it from a totally different way. And I think the same thing is true if you look at something like a child who is adopted and you say, well, I feel different. I feel different from my family. Well, if you're a changeling and you're actually a fairy who's, you know, had the original child taken and, you know, you're left in their place, you don't have to ask, is this a bad feeling or a good feeling? This now literalizes it. It lets you look at it, you know, and we all feel different in different ways. And that alienation, again, look at being an alien. You have shows on TV like Roswell, which say, okay, let's literalize it. What does that mean?
That's interesting. You're sort of suggesting that there's a powerful role for the imagination here in terms of our own kind of mental health and self-acceptance. The biblical scholar Karen Armstrong likes to talk about how in our secular culture we've forgotten to cultivate what she calls the religious imagination. I'm wondering, do you think there might be such a thing as a magical imagination?
The religious imagination, let me make sure I understand this, is about the idea of sort of that we all myth make, that we all need a sort of sense of ourselves as important. Is that how you would characterize that?
I think so. And I think also an awareness of our ability to feel transcendence,
mm-hmm.
and the development of a language for that. I think she would say that our secular culture has forgotten, first of all, to tell people that experiences of transcendence and a sort of plugging into something bigger and vaster than we are is sort of part of our birthright, and then we've forgotten to help people articulate that.
I don't think that necessarily the magical imagination is so different from that, in the sense that the idea of a mythic self or a mythic structure to our lives, the idea of sort of looking to the myth-making process that casts us as the hero on our own individual journey, I think is very much rooted in our sense of culture. And I think whether it's secular or religious, I think largely depends on your view of religion. But I think that we all, as people, participate in magical thinking, which is very much about the idea of magical imagination. We all, perhaps not all of us, but I think in our dark hearts, we all believe we have a lucky tie or lucky socks. You know, we all remember if we ate toast and jam before each time, you know, some good thing happened at the office. And we think, oh, well, you know, I want something good to happen. I'm going to eat toast and jam now. You know, we create rituals, even if we know they're silly, that are very much about the idea that there is some magic out there that we might be able to harness. You know, we all sort of look out of the corner of our eye at things and think, what is that? You know, could there be something out there? Could the world be bigger and maybe scarier but also more interesting.
So now is that a good thing or not such a good thing? Because I'm thinking we have such ambivalence about this tendency. You know, we also call this superstitiousness, and psychologists will warn clients not to slip into magical thinking. But then we also all go out and buy books like The Secret, which tell us that what we think about, we can make happen.
I mean, you know, I have a friend who always says, you know, everyone has a ghost story. And I think that we are pattern seekers as people. And we are interested in a world that is bigger and in which we have some power. And I don't know whether that's a good thing or a bad thing. I think that is. It is how we are as people, and I think fantasy can speak to that in a way that isn't about patronizing or isn't about, you know, just embracing superstition, but it is about sort of questioning the ambivalence. And I think really good fantasy has a certain degree of ambivalence about it. Really good fantasy talks about magic as something with cost and something complicated.
I'm curious about your own view of sort of the nature of reality. I mean, has writing fantasy stories and participating in this genre changed the way you think about the way we perceive reality? I guess what I'm asking is, do you write your stories because you wish the world had more magic in it or because you think it actually does?
Well, actually, I think that one of the reasons that I write about fantasy is I was definitely raised with a very strong idea that the world was full of things, magic, that all this stuff was true. When I was a kid, my mom, you know, very much believed in ghosts, very much believed in magic. You know, when I was a little kid, I would ask her, is there anything out there? Are things going to get me? You know, what about whatever's outside my window or under my bed or in my closet? And she was like, well, you know, that stuff probably won't get you.
That's but, not a very you know, reassuring she, answer.
but she absolutely didn't say that stuff isn't real. You know, she definitely believed that there were things out there that could menace you. And so I grew up with a sense that this was all real. And so being an adult was very much about questioning all of the stuff I had grown up believing. So for me, I guess like anyone who has a childhood that's seeped in some tradition, it's very easy for me to go back to a place in which I believe all this stuff is real. It's very easy for me to invoke that place. I remember running home from my friend's house because I thought the trees would reach down and grab me as I ran to my house.
You said when you grew up, you kind of had to reevaluate that view of reality that you had when you were growing up as a child. Was that hard? I mean, did that amount to a kind of crisis of faith?
Absolutely. It was definitely something where I had to say, so how much of this was real? How much of this was true? You know, it's a very strange thing because, you know, I think people have parallel experience where they question the religion they were raised in or they, you know, but I think very few people question the sort of weirdly mythic version of reality that I was raised with.
But I mean, how do you feel about that now? Do you think that you grew up with a lot of lies or do you think that you grew up in an enchanted world and that that was wonderful?
I think my mother was honest. I think this is a world that she very much believes in. So I don't think I grew up with lies. And I think that there were a lot of things about it that were really wonderful. I mean, I remember she created this scavenger hunt from the fairies. And, you know, I had an awareness that she was part of it. And, you know, she was not constructing this in some kind of trap-like way. But I remember, you know, she had created it. And then I went around and did it. And while I was going around, I would look in all these sort of knot holes in trees. And I really believed that even though I knew she had sort of created the scavenger hunt, that I was finding evidence, you know, that fairies were real. And that was really wonderful and really magical and something that I really remember. I also remember that my mom told me that if I had an out-of-body experience, that I should be really careful because something else could get into my body and walk around with it. So I should really be careful of that, which terrified me. It terrifies me to this day that I might somehow accidentally have an out-of-body experience and be possessed. So, I mean, there's two sides to it. But it's very easy for me to get back into that frame of mind.
Tell me something about the particular mythic tradition you work in fairy legends. What was it in particular, do you think, about the fairy or that fey world that drew you to it?
I think that my first experience of it, my mom had this coffee table book called Fairies by Brian Froud and Alan Lee. And I remember looking through it, and the fairies in it were dangerous, and the stories about them were frightening. And the thing that I found so fascinating about it is we have this idea of fairies as sort of glittery little Tinkerbell-like creatures with wings. But in fairy traditions, people wouldn't even say the word fairy because they would be afraid of getting their attention. They would call them the good people or the little people or the people of peace, not because they were good or little or peaceful, but because they hoped that by saying that, they would flatter fairies into, you know, not blighting their crops, not stealing their children, you know, not bothering them. So the more I read about it, the more I became just really interested. The other thing about fairy that I really, really love is that the stories of it, they're like ghost stories in that they have no end. They're just this weird story of people experiencing this strange world for a moment and then sort of it receding. And the idea of the sort of numinous and the magical being right up against our mundane world fascinates me. There's this great story in this book by Dermot McManus called The Middle Kingdom. And Dermot went out and he interviewed people about their real experiences with fairies. And one of the stories that he was told is about this guy who built a house. And he was supposed to have consulted the local specialist who would tell you where it was okay to build your houses and, you know, where the fairies wouldn't like it. But he didn't do that. He just built his house. And he heard this banging and knocking against one of the walls every night, like a train was going by. But, you know, he was in the middle of nowhere. There was no train. And so he finally belatedly goes to this fairy specialist. And the fairy specialist says, well, you know, you built your house on a fairy path and they don't like that. And he was like, well, what do I do? And they were like, you know, this person was like, well, you're very, very lucky, because you only built a corner on the fairy path, so cut off the corner. And so he went back and he cut off the corner. And there's this great picture of this house with the corner cut off. And that's what he did. And thereafter, there was no banging and knocking. But what there was this, every now and again, this sound, like a great whooshing of wind past that one corner.
Wow.
I love stories like that. They make the hair stand up on my arms.
Holly Black is a best-selling fantasy author. Her latest book is called The Good Neighbors, Book One, Kin. Black spoke with Anne Strangechamps. What do you think about fairies and mythological creatures? You can send us email through our website at ttbook.org. It's always nice to hear from you. Well, coming up, a skeptic's adventures in C.S. Lewis's fantastic fictional universe of Narnia, as we conclude our Hour on Magical Thinking. I'm Jim Fleming. It's to the best of our knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. The Magician's Nephew is one of the books in C.S. Lewis's famous children's fantasy series, The Chronicles of Narnia. Although it was the sixth book published in the series, it's actually the first in the chronology of the Narnia series' fictional universe. Here's actor Kenneth Branagh reading an excerpt from Chapter 3 of The Magician's Nephew, The Wood Between the Worlds.
It was the quietest wood you could possibly imagine. There were no birds, no insects, no animals, and no wind. You could almost feel the trees growing. The pool he'd just got out of was not the only pool. There were dozens of others, a pool every few yards as far as his eyes could reach. You could almost feel the trees drinking the water up with their roots. This wood was very much alive. When he tried to describe it afterward, Diggory always said, "It was a rich place, as rich as plum cake." The strangest thing was that almost before he'd looked about him, Diggory had half forgotten how he had come there. At any rate, he was certainly not thinking about Polly or Uncle Andrew or even his mother. He was not in the least frightened or excited or curious. If anyone had asked him, "Where did you come from?" he would probably have said, "I've always been here." That was what it felt like, as if one had always been in that place and never been bored, although nothing had ever happened. As he said long afterward, "It's not the sort of place where things happen. The trees go on growing, that's all." After Diggory had looked at the wood for a long time, he noticed that there was a girl lying on her back at the foot of a tree a few yards away. Her eyes were nearly shut, but not quite, as if she were just between sleeping and waking. So he looked at her for a long time and said nothing, and at last she opened her eyes and looked at him for a long time, and she also said nothing. Then she spoke, in a dreamy, contented sort of voice. "I think I've seen you before," she said.
"I rather think so too," said Diggory.
"Have you been here long?"
"Oh, always," said the girl. "At least, I don't know, a very long time."
"So have I," said Diggory.
"No, you haven't," said she. "I've just seen you come up out of that pool."
"Yes, I suppose I did," said Diggory with a puzzled air. "I'd forgotten." Then for quite a long time neither said any more.
Kenneth Branagh with an excerpt from the audiobook version of The Magician's Nephew by C.S. Lewis. The book is one of the novels from Lewis's classic children's fantasy series, The Chronicles of Narnia. Laura Miller recently reread The Chronicles of Narnia. She wrote about the experience in a book called The Magician's Book, A Skeptic's Adventures in Narnia. Miller told Steve Paulson about her long-time relationship with Narnia.
The most vivid memory of my childhood is of a day when I just wanted to be there so badly that it seemed impossible that I could not actually go there. I know I must have been really young because at that point I think I must have been grappling with the idea that Narnia was, in fact, a made-up place instead of a real place. And I'd been sort of postponing that realization for a long time because there was nothing in the world that I wanted more than to go to Narnia.
Why did you want to go there so much?
Oh, that is a really interesting question. I think that I thought that where I was kind of dull, and that if I could go to Narnia, I would be in the middle of a world of stories where anything could happen. I would be able to talk to animals, and there would be all these amazing creatures, and I would have important things to do, like the kind of quests that the children in the stories go on. And I think that I felt that my child's life in Southern California was kind of insignificant.
Now, one of the things that's so suggestive about your analysis of your experience with The Chronicle of Narnia is that it's partly a meditation on the power of books that we read when we're very young. And you suggest that sometimes those early experiences with just a really formative book may be the most intense reading experience we ever have in our life, more intense than any novel we might read as an adult.
I think that definitely is the case. In fact, I think most people feel that way. Part of it is that you're so open as a child. You're willing to believe that the things and stories are maybe true or kind of true. You don't have the attachment to the division between fiction and nonfiction that adults often insist upon. And you just are so impressionable. You don't know that an author might be trying to convince you of something, or you're not conscious of the tricks and techniques that writers use. The idea of symbolism isn't really significant. It's just a kind of a fresh, raw experience. And I often meet people who say, "Oh, I can remember as a child, I would just sit and read for hours and hours." And they, like me, were the kind of kids who someone could call their name from the next room. And if they were so deeply involved in a book, they wouldn't even hear that. They would just be oblivious to what was going on around them. And many adults really miss that experience, that kind of immersive totality of childhood reading. But we don't really talk about it much as adults. You know, we sort of say, "Oh, that was a book that I liked as a child." And, you know, we're sort of patronizing about what children believe in and what children like. And we don't really acknowledge the extent to which those early reading experiences, I think, shape us, obviously, as readers, but even more so as people. You just cannot have an experience that transformative and overpowering and not have it have a profound effect on you.
You know, C.S. Lewis has come in for a lot of criticism from Philip Pullman, one of today's most prominent writers of children's books, and it has to do with the character of Susan, who seems to be regarded differently from the other children once she's been seduced by what C.S. Lewis calls lipstick and nylons.
Yes, she becomes infatuated with invitations. She forgot the invitations. That was another thing that Susan got into that caused her to not be reunited with all of the characters at the end of the last book in Narnia. He had a lot of ambivalence and, you know, outright negative feelings about women, grown women, as positive as his little girl characters were. There are very few really believable women of childbearing age in the Narnia stories who are not in some way evil or sinister. He just had a very complicated psychosexual makeup, not to put too fine a point on it. And one of the things that I write about in the central part of the book is in three parts that stand for childhood reading, adolescent reading, and truly adult reading. But the adolescent part is really about disillusionment. And when I came to understand that ambivalent, mostly negative attitude that C.S. Lewis had toward grown women and sexuality, you know, that was part of the disillusioning experience for me. The first thing that I really objected to when I realized it, which I didn't for quite a long time, was the Christian symbolism in the books, because I had been raised in the Catholic Church, but I had lost my faith and was pretty alienated from it. And I continue to be an agnostic. So I just felt, when I realized that this symbolism was there, I just rejected the books, you know, completely.
And I'm guessing that's a pretty common experience. I mean, I love these books as a kid myself. Yeah. I had no clue that there was anything Christian about them.
I can't tell you how many times I have heard that story.
And then later I found that out. And when I went back and read them in my 20s, I couldn't get past it. I mean, it just it seemed like it was everywhere. And it was really annoying.
That's how it was for me. I just was so annoyed. The books had been so important to me. I felt kind of betrayed and tricked, and as if I had thought I was having this pure experience of joy, but I had really been being used or manipulated. And, you know, I could not get past that for a long time. And in reading what other people had written about the books, because most of the people who write about them are believers, they're not troubled by that. And so I had a hard time finding any scholarship or criticism of the books that really took into account whatever it was that could continue to move me, even after I recognized the sort of religious message in there and kind of set it aside. I still found that there was a lot in all of these books that really moved me. And so I wanted to write a book that took account of that.
But some of that symbolism is just, I mean, it almost does hit you over the head. I mean, Aslan, the godlike character, is sacrificed in the very first book. And, I mean, it's a story right out of the resurrection.
Well, it's a story also right out of Egyptian mythology and Greek mythology and Norse mythology. I mean, when Lewis wrote that scene, he was well aware of the fact that every major religious or mythological system has a story of a sort of a god king who dies, who is sacrificed, and whose sort of blood or whose sacrifice is used to renew the world. You know, he knew that that was one of the oldest stories in human cultures, even pre-Christian human cultures. And this was kind of his variation on that theme.
And it's worth pointing out that C.S. Lewis was not only a writer of these Chronicles of Narnia, he was a highly regarded scholar at Oxford and a famous writer about Christianity. I mean, a Christian apologist, some people would
call
him.
That's what he's best known for now, yes.
And so for people who are familiar with his Christian writings.
You know, I'm not a Christian, and yet I'm able to read The Divine Comedy or Paradise Lost or Spencer's The Faerie Queen or any number, Dostoevsky, any number of writers who put their Christian beliefs into their work without having to sort of sign on for the whole package and become a Christian in order to think this is, you know, a powerful work of literature. But no one had really done that with these books, partly because they're children's books and partly because I think a lot of people thought, well, there isn't anything else in there besides a Christian message. And so I wanted to say, oh, but there's this and this and this, and this is how it can be meaningful to someone who, you know, is not really, you know, a believer.
So you've spent a lot of time thinking about the Chronicles of Narnia and your whole relationship to them. I mean, over the course of your life, going back to, I don't know, when you were 9 years old or something, when you first read them, do you think they shaped you in ways that you didn't realize until now? I mean, it shaped your experience as a reader, for instance?
Well, they absolutely shaped my experience as a reader, both in this kind of really basic way of that I know how to read allegorically. I think that's something that Lewis taught me. I don't need a story to be strictly realistic in order for it to be truthful to me. I can see how truth can be presented in a fantastical form, and that in some ways it strikes home more powerfully in that form. And that is something that we get, you know, from something as simple as fairy tales and something as sort of powerful as, say, Paradise Lost or the Greek myths. So there's that, you know, there's this ability to read both on the level of like a Jane Austen novel and on the level of Midsummer Night's Dream, and to see that that is a story not about ridiculous make-believe creatures, but about the forces inside human psyches. But then also what I finally came to realize, and Narnia taught me to do, was to hold my skepticism about a piece of literature, to hold it and to value it, because that skepticism has value. It is important. And yet to not have it just impinge on my ability to really enjoy and enter into a work of art. You know, that's a really tricky balancing act that only an adult can really do. And it took me a long time to figure that out. And I think in the process of thinking about these books, as simple as they might seem as children's books, they were the most exaggerated case of that. They were the most exaggerated situation in which I had to say, there's this thing that I really don't like or I really can't entirely accept, but then there's this which is really beautiful and really powerful to me. And I can feel both of those things at the same time and not feel like the experience is somehow less. In a way, it's more, because it's a richer, fuller experience.
Laura Miller is the author of The Magician's Book, A Skeptic's Adventures in Narnia. She spoke with Steve Paulson. It's to the best of our knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. If you'd like a copy of this hour, you can call the radio store at 1-800-747-7444 and ask for program number 111A, Magical Thinking. If you have questions or comments about the program, you can send us email through our website at ttbook.org. To the Best of Our Knowledge is produced by Wisconsin Public Radio. This program was produced by Doug Gordon, with help from Mary Lou Finnegan, Ann Strainchamps, Charles Monroe Kane, and Veronica Rickert. Our executive producer is Steve Paulson. Our technical director is Kirill Owen. You can stream To the Best of Our Knowledge on our website at ttbook.org, where you will also find a link to the weekly podcast.
PRI, Public Radio International.